Yeah, you're at least assessing the appropriateness of the penalty because there was limited material there. Even though the trial record does indicate that there was a significant investigation conducted, funds allocated for a mitigation specialist, and certainly psychological report. At minimum, that's the type of information we need first to make a legitimate determination whether the death penalty should be imposed. And then certainly the facility is important to review. If after that review is conducted, that of course the individual who is competent and may withdraw further proceedings. But I strongly urge that at the ground level we make the determination one that is as comprehensive as possible. That created a problem for this trial court in particular because Judge Frost and the remaining members of the panel were under the impression that there was no mitigating evidence that they could even consider because of the elapsed decision not to pursue.
So probably the better procedure would have been for the trial judges to require the attorney to do an investigation of this person and present mitigating evidence.
And there was, I have to acknowledge that there is a problem there with certainly with our disciplinary guidance can't accept it. There's a real conflict there of whether we can force the attorney to violate that client's trust. There might be a better suggestion or an alternative to standby counsel, just as we might do in the guilt phase proceeding, or at least to come forward to the court and say that there was an investigation done, Your Honor. There is available mitigating evidence that is relevant to the penalty of death. Again, it's a delicate balance, and it's difficult. But yes, the overriding concern here is whether or not the death penalty is warranted for the individual. Without the ability to consider the individual as a foregone conclusion, as the trial judge has stated, concluded here.
Where do we draw that line, though? We have lots of cases and lots. We get in every case where there is hope outcome of the census. They do contend from death if they have very weak resistance mitigation, sometimes because they don't want to open the door, sometimes they just want to wind up on how to do much. Do we then say, well, the council calling their clients into the house are playing offended standby counsel for this because there could have been mitigation evidence, but they should have been better than they didn't. It's like a slippery slope, where do we draw the line?
Very much so, Your Honor. I think this is a very unique circumstance. In the civil case, the one that this court has always reviewed, there has been full counsel, and the decision to present and investigate is guided by the standard of service. In effect, this is a count. That's always been our guideline in determining the appropriate scope of investigation and presentation of mitigation evidence. It's also an important distinction in that it's not merely the decision to not open doors or to preclude certain evidence. There can be legitimate decisions about how to approach or pursue the mitigation phase of a case. Prior to McGuire, for example, it was well accepted that an individual could pursue a theory of residual doubt to the exclusion, perhaps, of other compelling mitigating evidence. And if that decision is wrapped in debate and well presented, then this court has always said that it's in fact legitimate. The difference here, however, is that we don't have a full-blown testing of the parameters of the guilt. The guilt acknowledges its responsibility to that completed guilt as well as responsibility and punishment, but in so doing, restricted the court from just engaging in any type of analysis of him. The trial court, I think more importantly, not so much as failed to present evidence, the trial court here was under the mistaken impression that there was nothing else to review on the basis of the record, and that's absolutely incorrect. There was mitigating evidence based upon this record, based upon the evidence that was before the court that should have been considered. It existed in a number of forms. First, there were two competency determinations, both of which the report went to some detail about the LF's background. That very type of background and character evidence is what is required under Walken before the death penalty can be imposed, and it was readily before the trial court. Beyond the constitutional requirements, there were statutory mitigating factors available on the face of the record. There was a statutory mitigating factor of abuse. There was a statutory mitigating factor of remorse, which is readily apparent in this case from Dale's candid acknowledgement of guilt, his willingness to accept responsibility for what he did to Mr. Baker and Mr. Baker's family.
On that subject, Counselor, we don't often get a chance to ask this question, and it's been bothering me since I started reading the briefs here and seeing how he, in effect, just laid down and said, I give up, I did it, and do this to me. Can you tell me, assuming his confidence, what does he feel today?
He's very much the same, Your Honor. I mean, Dale has never wavered from decision or his understanding that what he did was a terrible thing to do. He has never questioned it. He's never frankly regretted the fact that he took responsibility for that. Every time I meet with Dale, the impression I come up with is that he literally despises himself for what he has done, and he doesn't question that he made a correct decision in acknowledging the wrongness of the past. What differs, though, is that as a 24-year-old, he certainly regrets the decision not to let the trial court consider himself in assessing penalties. He doesn't want to die.
That's my ultimate question. Do you gather from him, because he knew what the results were going to be, waiving all of his rights?
Certainly.
He knew he was going to get the death penalty, and that meant at that point the electric chair. Now, has that changed?
It has. It has changed, Your Honor. In fact, not very long after sentencing proceeding, Dale changed his mind. And honestly, it didn't surprise me. A lot of us, we see a big change in clients in the year after they've been in a structured environment away from drugs, and Dale takes away from the alcohol. A lot of times, they say he doesn't regret the fact that he came forward and acknowledged his crime. He never waived.
Well, where I'm going with the question is that this is not going to be another case like State v. Berry, then. That we go up to the 11th hour and he says, look, I'm telling you people what I want and you won't even give me what I want.
No.
We shouldn't consider that in our deliberations at all.
No, Your Honor. In fact, in light of what we've learned from the Berry process, that's why we thought it was important to get an affidavit from Dale when he invoked his right to direct appeal.
Mm-hmm.
Also supporting his decision to proceed with post-conviction, which he has and which he has been worked very hard and very strongly with the post-conviction. And now, you do not take the problem based on what I know right now and change his mind.
The reason I ask is because the Berry test was used here.
That's correct.
And there's some question whether or not the Berry test was right. In your brief, you indicate that there seems to be some indication that really the U.S. Supreme Court affirmed what the district court did. But the U.S. Supreme Court really didn't do that, did they? They just refused to hear it before the Sixth Circuit finished.
No, I would disagree with that. That issue is a precise issue that's currently pending before the United States Supreme Court.
Okay.
I would stand by that authority. I think that it's a correct view of it. But obviously, the Sixth Circuit disagrees by the panel. So, acknowledges obviously a different opinion.
Bob, isn't your argument your argument that at the trial level, where the defendant may not fully realize the consequences of what he agreed to or stipulated in a way that for his benefit and perhaps for the benefit of the system that we should provide a defendant such as him who disavows an interest in providing mitigation testimony and so forth and evidence that the system needs to, if the right word is protect, at least it provides assistance to him. Beyond that, if once he's found guilty or once the defendant's found guilty and sentenced to death, if the decision then is, well, I'm sentenced to death, I've been found guilty, now let's get on with it. I don't want to sit on death row for however many years I'm going to sit on death row. If that's the distinction, I would guess I take it that you're making between Berry's sort of case and this case. Is that my correct?
There is a distinction there, Your Honor. Then you run into a problem with individuals changing their mind over the time. This is very, very, very. I mean, Dale made that decision after he was arrested, not long thereafter, but he made the decision to be guilty with the understanding that in all likelihood, because of death penalty, it's a very different situation, saying, I want to be executed. And certainly he changed his mind, so it takes on very different context than as the other cases the court has reviewed. He never has, although the issue of whether or not the trial court was predisposed necessarily impacts the guilty plea as well to some extent. There's a pre-bump. The reason that bias can come into play is in under the well, first context, if there's a bias, trial judge, bias senator, for example, the entire proceedings avoid it being a structural defect. But beyond that, it's not merely the fact that the plea of guilty, no matter what the judge's process is accepting the plea of guilty, there has to be the presentation of some evidence to support the elements of the crime. There has to be consideration of possible lesser included offense. Now, to start from the assumption that the trial judge is always presumed to find guilty and presumed to determine the penalty already, then that process is a wash. It's there for a reason.
Absolutely. Aren't there three possibilities?
The term reweighing, you may be giving that undue weight in that that's the only term that could be used when it's the second weighing. Does that necessarily mean that this court necessarily is affected, must be affected by a prior decision of a trial court?
I think it does. We don't simply bypass the trial process through a mechanism of independent review. The individual has a constitutional right, a liberty interest in fact, in the determination of that sentence, whether it be trial judge or trial jury. And once again, you can't forget the fact that the trial court is in the best position to consider witness,
right,
demeanor, credibility. There's a whole...
What we'd be saying is that where there has been no weighing, and this may be the first case that there is such a thing, that the argument that there's been no weighing, that it's harmless error. That'd be what we'd have to be saying, that it's harmless error, and we, our independent review, can account for that.
Effectively, yes.
Mm-hmm.
Should you get to that point, you would have to be doing harmless error again.
Would that have to be harmless beyond a reasonable doubt?
You would have to be. I didn't have a problem getting that special review. I do have a question.
I just want to go back and follow up on my question. In looking at the trial court's opinion, how you say that the court has taken the decision for the death penalty, but we must accept the opinion of the three-judge panel, and it appears that they did, in fact, consider the mitigating factors, and they also, they weighed those against the aggravating circumstances and came to their conclusion. So you're asking us to read something into, to ignore this opinion, but we do have in front of us an opinion that appears that they wish to do that weighing process.
I don't think you should ignore this opinion. In fact, I think you should draw guidance. The three-judge panel's opinion clearly states that no mitigating factors were presented by the defense. No mitigating factors were presented by the state in the form of the evidence that is presented in support of the charges. It ignores entirely the trial court's independent obligation to review the record. Certainly there was...
But they go on, though. That's what I was pointing out. They go on. They make no defense in no way and use to facilitate the defense. Now, they even comment on the fact that although the defendant points to the victim made homosexual advances for the defendant, this court specifically finds that such advances, if true, in no way induced and facilitated the defense. And then they go on and go through the whole weighing process.
But missing from the opinion is a very important component. Character, background evidence required by law is a separate apart from our statute for the mitigating factors. There certainly is no articulation of use as a mitigating factor, regardless of what weight might have been put on it. No acknowledgement of one of the most important factors of this case is that Dale Edwards came forward and pleaded guilty to this crime. That should be worth something in the sentencing determination. And my concern with the opinion is that it doesn't articulate the presence of any of these important factors, much less alone how they may have been weighed into the process. Regardless of how that evidence might have been weighed in the end, it's a wholesale failure to consider it. not what the result might have been.
I want to go back to the practical question that I was asking you earlier, because it still concerns me now, or the ultimate question is, how do we... You can't set aside the conviction here. I mean, the man stands before the judges and says, I did it, and this is what a skeptical public always wonders. Why do we set aside cases where everybody knows this man did it? So you can't set aside the conviction very well. That brings us down to the death penalty. How do you prevent... And I don't know that I want to use the word prevent, but how do you prevent this from occurring in every subsequent case? Whenever somebody sees, all I have to do is say, I'm not going to present any mitigation. And from then on, I know I'm not going to get the death penalty because the Supreme Court will say, wasn't fair. They didn't have anything to review.
That's where you draw the line between the individual's desire to represent the rest of his there is a line. At some point, you say to the defendant, we recognize your wishes, we respect them, but we can't do our job if we know a little bit more about you. We consider the entire record. We tell the trial court that it's not merely a review of what the state might have been presented, what the defendant might have presented. It is a careful coach review of everything before the trial court. And in a case like this, where we have already gone through the time and the expense and the energy of investigating the individual, I think it does make sense at that point, though. I stand by counsel, like we would in any other criminal trial where an individual wants to represent himself, to present to the judge evidence of mitigation that should be considered. That's how you avoid it, Your Honor.
So back to Justice Resnick's question, even though a person doesn't want a defense, we force a defense on because that's what the rules require.
So it's much more than that, Your Honor. It's not only that the rules require it, it's that the state is not even empowered to execute unless there has been full evaluation of the individual. And you certainly guard against the position we're in right now. You certainly guard against it. I mean, this isn't doing anything in the long run but taking up time, frankly. And have we done it at trial, ensure that the individual is considered, and make sure that you show a lot of
decency? I think in this case, this is a very good case. I think that this record is extremely complete, even in the face of that this particular defendant didn't want all of the justice and the remorseful and admitted his act. But we do have psychological reports. We have all of those kinds of things. So the court, three judges, knew more about this, knew everything. I would say they knew everything about this individual. They knew everything about the nature and circumstances of the crime.
But perhaps in the future, the better practice is to have standby numbers. I think that's correct. I agree. I was trying to quite surprise the amount of information that's in this record. And gather the indication that the trial panel recognizes there was more information than simply what was presented in that one trial proceeding. We might not have a problem at all. And it's certainly a better practice if we direct the trial court not only to consider what is ever directed, but articulate the process. Give us some basis to say, there is the evidence that we can be assured that these trial judges went through the record, articulated what they thought might have been mitigating, regardless of what weight they gave to it. That's the better practice. That's what ensures the integrity of the process. And that's what this court has confidence that the decision was arrived at from the record.
In this case, I think you touched on it, but why is it that you're telling me that you're saying the record, when we go through the record, we will find all of the information that the trial court should have, and your community should have, and perhaps didn't review. We have that in the record. Why does that, for this case, why does that not cure whatever defect that was the trial court's suggestion?
It doesn't cure, Your Honor, because it's still a term that there is an independent liberty interest of the right that the original trial defense to consider that evidence in the first instance. And as an appellate panel, regardless of the amount of evidence you have, you're still never going to be able to prove the credibility, demeanor, or certain witnesses. And that's an important aspect of mitigation and an important aspect of defense. Your Honor, to close briefly, there is a
negligibility.
Good morning, Your Honor. This case has already been alluded to presents one issue, essentially, and that is whether this court will ever allow a capital defendant to waive his right and waive his right to present mitigation evidence. And I say ever because if it's ever going to be allowed, it's going to be allowed on this record.
Counsel, yes. I just want to make sure that we had counsel.
Actually, over the course of the proceedings, he had a total of three attorneys.
They switched along the way and then counsel, but he actually had counsel the hearing for guilty and counsel.
Correct.
And at the time, the mitigation hearing was that counsel.
The same counsel.
The doctor's theory that maybe if we wait in the case and do some point standby, do we have to do that then in every case where they have a full trial and test it, are found guilty, and then found that we don't have any mitigation to see now, then we then have to go out and point standby for that?
Not only do you, would you have to do it in that case, you would have to do it in a case where a trial counsel presented some marginal mitigation, and somebody else looking over his shoulder said, wait a minute, why did you present this? Independent counsel should be appointed to present this additional mitigation. You chose not to present.
This wasn't a case where we had a pro se.
Correct. He had counsel and representation at the time of the plea and mitigation from that counsel was, Your Honor, we believe Mr. Ashworth knows what he's doing, and this has been done against our advice.
Well, but we have a system to look at, too, don't we? This case is a good example. Here we are with an arguably imperfect record because a defendant has been permitted to control the evidence that's been presented. Now, that seems like something we allow people to do, but it's a death case. And people do seem to sometimes change their mind, their attitude about death. I guess looking at it from not from the defendant's standpoint, what about the system? Why wouldn't it be better for the system to simply require that where a defendant says, I don't care about mitigation, I'm not going to defend myself, and then, you know, with the prospect that that person may change their mind later, why wouldn't it be better just for the system for us to provide some, call it whatever you want, but to provide some means by which there is evidence presented on behalf of the defendant in spite of his
first of all, there's two reasons. One is a constitutional issue. We're talking about constitutional protections of the Eighth Amendment versus a defendant's Sixth Amendment right to represent and present a defense as he sees fit. On this record, we're talking about competence. So it's not an issue of the state is the only interest. The defendant is a constitutional right. If he doesn't want to make excuses for his conduct, well, who are we to play Big Brother and bring me up to?
The problem is, here we are. Here we are with a case that really, I mean, we shouldn't be arguing this point, probably, because if there'd been a record, then we wouldn't, you know, we're using time, as the counsel said, we're using time and resources for an issue that could be, looking at systemically or institutionally, could be taken care of at the trial level. I think that's the issue.
Correct. That's the next issue. I don't think you can come up with a procedure that will solve this problem for two reasons. In those instances where the defendant says, I do not want mitigation presented on my behalf and maintains that throughout, he's going to be in front of you saying, wait a minute, that independent counsel violated my Sixth Amendment rights. We're going to be arguing a different issue. But we'll be here. And in those situations, when the independent counsel is appointed, what remedies do we have from misuse by that independent counsel? What if, in a given case, and I'm not saying this is one of them, but let's look down the road. A given defendant's tactical decision to avoid the death penalty and stand up in front of the jury and say, I want no mitigation presented, what I did was wrong, I'm not making excuses for it, and ladies and gentlemen of this jury, if you think what I did justifies the death penalty, then give it to me. Thank you. Are we going to have to do an independent counsel? Wait a minute. He didn't present mitigating evidence. In that particular case, he's doing it as tactical decision to avoid the death penalty. Are we still going to force him to? The other instance is, well, what if Edward has found that somebody else wants to look over the shoulder and say, wait a minute, present some more. And if we put independent counsel, what role then does the defendant have? Let him then account present all this life history of the defendant. The defendant doesn't want to present it. Now, if he's going to stand up in front of the jury and say, don't believe my mother. I wasn't abused as a kid. She's lying to you, ladies and gentlemen. I deserve the death penalty, which is what I want. What a ludicrous circus that would cause. Not only the defendant not fighting it, he's now having to be put in the position to advocate.
Because there are times when a defendant does not want to present mitigating evidence. For example, if he has a serious criminal history, committed 5 aggravated robberies, he certainly not going to want to have the jury consider that. And he
has
to choose not to present any.
He may say, make the statement to the jury. You said what I did. I admit my guilt. I'm not making any excuses. I don't want any excuses made for me. Do you think I deserve the death penalty? Then give it to me.
Do you all really think we're confronted with a problem?
What's that?
You don't really think we're confronted with a problem?
I don't think we are confronted with a problem that we can solve given the respect the system has to have for the Sixth Amendment right for the competent capital defendant to choose his own court.
So this case could be written with that as a syllabus, and 2 pages of facts and 1 page decision. Saying that any competent individual can waive their rights, including the right to mitigation, in a capital case.
Well, let me back up on the facts of this case. I'm taking that have this.
Yeah, but you recognize, counsel, we have to write not for just this case, but for the universe of cases that we're seeing and will continue to come.
You're correct. What I'm saying, I want to point to things in this case that should be present in every case.
Okay.
First of all, you are starting with a statutory or a constitutional scheme of a death penalty. In other words, there's no dispute that before we ever get to the waiving of mitigation, this has to be one of the people eligible for the death penalty. That is, the scheme on which he's charged narrows the eligible offender. The Constitution, which favors the Jenkins Bill behind the Constitution, is a constitutional scheme. Okay, this isn't a defendant that comes in for felonious assault or manslaughter and says, no, death penalty. Or murder, not the death penalty. It's aggravated murder. Protection number one. If it doesn't exist, he can want the death penalty all he wants. And he ain't going to get it. Second of all, in Ohio, every aggravated murder death penalty case has to be prosecuted by grand jury indictment. You can't waive that right. Under the protection. If it doesn't get to the grand jury, you can't get to the point of waiving mitigation. In Ohio, you plead guilty. It has to be in front of a 3-judge panel. A 3-judge panel is who is required to accept testimony, not just the factual basis from the prosecutor, but testimony, and despite all the other rights you're waiving by guilty plea, you nonetheless do not waive the obligation of the state to prove the specification by proof beyond a reasonable doubt. Even on a guilty plea. After that, we have the requirement of the 3-judge panel, even if the defendant can't present anything, to look at the facts of the case and find out if there's mitigation here. No dispute the assessment that the trial court did. As Judge Resnick pointed out, it goes to several things. That aren't mentioned. I didn't stand up and tell the court, Your Honor, you ought to consider this man's age and weigh that if you think it's mitigation. But the opinion mentions that this man is fully in the door. I didn't, nor did anybody else mention to the court, Your Honor, you ought to consider the allegations of the homosexual things against the defendant that prompted his rage. But the court obviously looked at it. There's another protection. All I'm saying is it's a balance of competing interests. And Ohio, and therefore every case in Ohio that follows the rules that Ohio requires, will give protection to the defendant. And then the cases, if not the one, where competency is questioned, like state versus Perry, there's another thing to do. So I'm going from the facts of this case to the things that will come up in every case. Justice Douglas, if all those met in every case, and that is confident in all of these protections are not stepped on, waived. You do have the right of the defendant to do that.
Judge Frost, I think, you know, recognized it. I know because I've been in classes or lectured on the death penalty with judges, and we go over it every time. The statute says that if aggravation outweighs mitigation, the penalty shall be death. The General Assembly is not discretionary. The General Assembly has said this is the penalty. It's the same thing when it comes here. We can feel like it's unfair or whatever, but it says it shall be given.
It shall be given provided the aggravated circumstances outweigh the mitigation.
And that's all they were saying at this point. The statute says this is our only alternative if this is so.
Correct. Absolutely what they, my assessment, what they've always said. If there's any ambiguity or anomaly, it would make crystal clear on the Gene Tech hearing, not only about what the court said, what the prosecutor indicated to the court in closing is we understand you have the duty of weighing of any mitigation you have to define. The defense attorney said the same thing. And then the opinion, an opinion incidentally, the whole purpose in the revised code 29.2903, the whole purpose of that opinion is to spell out this weighing process. If the court didn't understand it had a duty to look at, look for mitigation and thereafter weigh it, the opinion doesn't. The whole purpose of that opinion is to set forth their assessment of our mitigating factors and the government can suggest that, well, this issue wasn't raised as it's addressed.
Well, maybe that's because the court didn't feel it was mitigating.
The entire fact had that right to conclude, we don't think it's mitigating. We don't have to weigh it. It's not meet the definition of mitigating evidence. It's for the factors. So the fact is not something, or something is not there, they simply, we don't consider mitigating evidence. And this is the case. They cannot get an odd thing here to insist, that a defendant goes to mitigation, whether he likes it or not, has the potential for an absolute absurd result. An absurd result, some of which I mentioned about having to argue against the independent counsel trying to get him off death row, and that's where he wants to be. But another one. Well, nobody here is advocating that a criminal capital defendant shouldn't be allowed to plead guilty, but in many cases, the best defense, the best challenge, the best protection against getting a death verdict is expected being found guilty of something that's not eligible for the death penalty. It's manslaughter. It's murder, not aggravated murder. It's aggravated murder, but it doesn't have death effect after all. But we're going to stand by, and nobody from this side is suggesting we should demand that. You can't even plead guilty to aggravated murder with death effect, even though that's your best shot of avoiding death penalty. In other words, you have great defense on the guilt stage, but we'll let you leave it anyway, even though you may have absolutely no mitigating evidence for that, which is your son's life and death.
Absolutely. If we can then, we have options and we stand by counsel, if we have a client, what
will be the end? You got me. I haven't got a clue. And that's where I point out it. Well, what remedy does the criminal defendant have for that attorney's mistake? If my tactical decision is to stand up and say, ladies and gentlemen of the jury, I'm not making excuses for what I did, given the death penalty thing is appropriate, I accept full responsibility, thank you very much. And the independent counsel proceeds to truck one family member after another in, and somehow something comes up that is the thing that caused the jury to say, well, you're going
We have something called the Anders brief. Is this somewhat like that? We know how to do it if the system knows how to do it if we want to do it.
In an Anders brief situation, you have a defendant that wants to pursue his rights, and the attorney's saying, well, there's no merit to this point. But you have a defendant wanting to do it. Here, you're saying, well, I'm still even though you don't want
to. This is the reverse.
Just out.
But we still have a method for finding for designating a lawyer to file an Anders brief. I think we could probably find a method for appointing a counsel to protect a defendant from what this defendant did.
Well, you may protect him in somebody else's system, but it may not be protection to him, and it may, in some cases, cause him harm in a scenario like this.
No, it's written by the lawyer.
But in an effort to protect, you may be doing him damage. Number one. And number two, to do what's advocated here by the appellant, you need to undo what you told in State v. Tyler, which is State v. Keene, State v. Senate, all of which combined, and State v. Johnson in DICTA, that said that waiving mitigation may be, quote, as a result of a, quote, demand of the accused. In those four cases, you can look at principles this court has announced that a defendant's refusal to present mitigation does not require an examination of competency. You don't have to stop things that will make sure he's competent before you allow it. You don't even need to do a formal waiver here. But in this case, we did. You need to set aside all of those. If there's anything, any further protection is justified by the facts of the case, further protection, then do and make necessary in all future cases what we've done in this case. aside from those institutional or statutory protections that I mentioned, things occurred in this case. First of all, on these four cases, over three different periods, the defendant was questioned, are you sure you want to do this? January 1st, 1997, April 16th, 1997, and twice on June 10th, 1997, both before the factual basis of testimony came, require that repeated inquiry to the defendant. Are you sure? Do you understand what you're doing? Required. I don't care. We did it in this case. Even though there's no mental illness history here, we did it, evaluation of competency. If you want further protection, say, yeah, we'll let him leave as long as there is examined the competency just for this particular person. But for one more protection. Constitution doesn't require reason statement requires competency assessment for waiting purposes only if there's a mental condition. But if you want to put another protection in that protects the system, the integrity of the system, the state's interest. Because I submit the state's interest is in being cautious. The state's interest is not to assume the role of Big Brother. And if you want to get one more protection, requires a formal waiver hearing. We did it today. Are you sure? Not just allow the secretary to say, my client doesn't want me to present to you. Thank you, Your Honor, for the question, and go on. Stop. If you're a jury trial, say, do you understand what this would mean to you, sir? Do you understand? Don't force something on the defendant that he does not want, that there is no way to apply their fact pattern, and it's going to cause more litigation. And quite frankly, has the potential for being used by the defendant as a tactical basis for challenge for appeal.
Let me understand exactly what you're saying, because we're going to have to draft, we're either going to have to draft criteria and standards as is being recommended by your learned adversary and yourself, or we're going to have to, I mean, just follow the statute specifically. First of all, when you find in 292903, the statement, the defendant shall have the burden of going forward with the evidence of any factors in mitigation of the death sentence. That's a clear obligation by the statute.
To go forward.
Now, the defendant says no.
Right.
Now, as I understand your argument, then the court is supposed to, whenever the trial court writes the sentencing opinion, has to consider, do we require the trial court to consider then all those mitigating factors in 292904B1 through 7? Do they have to say, we find age is not a factor?
No, do they specifically have to say that?
Yeah.
No. Do they have to make a general review of what they do here by way of testimony and determine if there's something of mitigating nature, and if they conclude it's mitigating, then weigh it. They have to do that. But whether they have to go through every statutory section.
Wait a minute, we just said they didn't hear anything. The defendant said nothing.
No.
You're talking about the report?
No. In the course of the testimony I presented,
yeah.
In the course of the defendant's appellant's statement to the police, he claimed that he beat this man to death, partly prompted because the victim had a homosexual advantage. The trial court heard that as part of the testimony of the defendant.
So all the trial court has to do is look at what the record before it is. Doesn't have to search out any one of those other factors.
That is correct.
And those would be the guidelines you want us to draw.
Well, those would be the guidelines followed by, if the reason that is the case, is the defendant is refusing to allow his attorney to do so, then on to a competency evaluation, if you like, on to a formal waiver hearing, if you like, and if you find that he's competent, and he knows what he's doing, if you understand voluntary, then accept the fact that he has that right.
Thank you. we got to keep on working the time.
Court's decision is pretty pointed in the words they choose. They say that they found that there were no mitigating factors contained within the testimony received incident to the acceptance of the plea. Do you think the court was being very specific there and saying we didn't look at anything else?
No.
Because we didn't have, nobody presented it?
I think they were being specific to alert this court that they did look at what the case, the state presented, and that's the only meaning of that passage.
You
have to then look beyond and look at pages 3 and 4 when it talks about the victim having allegedly made open sexual advances. I didn't ask that they consider that as a potential mitigating factor, but they did. In paragraph 3, they, or 4, excuse me.
Well, that's testimony incident to the plea, isn't it? That was part of the plea.
I'm not sure the defendant was fully engaged in the majority of came in as a psychological evaluation. I guess I don't know if that was part of the waiver hearing before the plea or not, but it certainly been fundamental in one way or the other.
But isn't the question, just for a difficult policy question for us, the one raised by Justice Piper, that here we have a record that arguably has mitigation evidence in the record, we can find it. Mr. Bodine's argument is, of course, in the trial court, we can't tell if the trial court really looked at the record and reviewed it, but isn't the more difficult question is, if the policy of the law is that, as you argue, as a defendant, to make that decision at the trial level, that bars him, that defines him forever, life or death, that he doesn't want to offer mitigation evidence. The next case may not have any mitigation evidence, and there may, in fact, be none that was never offered, but that the system would sometimes say, my gosh, we shouldn't be putting this person to death, because here's this evidence that, for some reason, he made the wrong decision back then. Now he wants us to review it because he's wiser, more mature, he's in a more structured setting, whatever the reason. His life is at stake. The issue seems to me to be whether the state wants to permit someone in his situation to make that decision that's forever binding.
I guess I would agree that this issue is a policy decision. It's assessment of constitutional issues, defendants, particularly might have to win. If you look at policy...
Well, he's arguing different. He's not concerned about Fifth Amendment right now. That's the dilemma. I know, but the dilemma is he's changed his mind and his life is at stake.
Well,
this is not a typical criminal case where somebody pays a fine or they serve 6 months in jail. This is life, and that's why this is a different... That's why we're looking at a different rule or a different issue, are we not?
Okay. Then I guess then what you have to say is we're never going to allow it as a matter of public policy. I would suggest that the legislative determination is to make.
Never allow what is a
mitigation to be made. If Ohio and policy is going to say we'll never allow it, and policy is our issue here.
What we could do, obviously, is confine us to death. I mean, you had sort of a bunch of horrible stories. The whole system is going to operate. So, if we're interested in setting the policy at all, it applies to a death defendant who is way to right.
So, I'm saying, if we assume that it's no longer an issue of constitutional question, that it's simply public policy. So much like, how do you even determine that? If you determine that it's a constitutional requirement, that's another issue. And when you talk about policy, I want
to use your time. Thank you. Mr. Bodine, you use your time to take a minute for a vote.
Very briefly. Does that take a right to use your time? Like the independent nature of that assessment that's important here. And that's what we have to focus on. Is there enough in this trial, is there enough guidance that in the future we can be certain that trial courts are going to consider as much as is necessary to ensure that the appropriate sentence is accurate and constitutional?
But isn't it up to the legislature to say that the defendant cannot waive mitigation evidence? Not us.
No, that's by the Constitution, Your Honor.
But the statute that the prosecuting attorney and the defendant or his counsel shall be permitted. So by those words, shall be permitted means that you can't deny the opportunity. If it were mandatory to present mitigating evidence, it would suggest that shall present the argument for against the death penalty. But they've added, the legislature added that word, shall be permitted.
Now that you're consistent with law, you can't restrict the worst of that scenario where there was very little mitigation presented. There was still some in the form of testimony that was obviously considered by the trial court or wouldn't have passed muster under this court. That's the distinction here. Not only that he didn't want to present that evidence to the trial court, didn't go beyond that decision independently reviewed. That's what makes this case unique.
But why should we have to change the mind if there's no real additional evidence? We have the psychological report. What did you present in the case?
If there were a full blown mitigation hearing, there would be additional evidence. And we know that based on this record, there was, in the investigation paid for by the state, an extensive review of his upbringing in a very small backwoods area in Louisiana, like education, drug alcohol. A lot of material available that would indicate on the record. So if it were a matter of doing a full level of penalty phase here, there's certainly more information that's available down on the basis of the record right now. It's there. My concern, though, is just in the review of this record, that the evidence that's there now, that's on the basis of this record, wasn't considered. That's a minimal requirement.
Thank you, Mr. Woody.
Thank you.
Case is submitted. You'll be advised for opinion.